the latest developments in Iran and the Middle East. It was 1 week ago today that the United States killed Iranian General Qasem Soleimani with a drone strike in Baghdad. Since then, events have unfolded rapidly, from Iran's retaliatory strikes on U.S. air bases to the downing of a Ukrainian jetliner, possibly by an Iranian missile. Late this morning, President Trump announced more sanctions against Iran. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Senator Angus King, former Ambassador Larry Pope, and Middle East scholars Aaron David Miller and Allison Hodgkins join us for perspective. Is the world a safer place with Soleimani gone? What's next for ISIS? How do these events affect other countries, including Israel, Russia, and China? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Tensions may have eased for now in the conflict between U.S. and Iran, but many questions remain about what may be next for these two countries and the region. Today, we'll discuss the unfolding events in the Middle East. Joining me in the studio, Allison Hodgkins, non-resident fellow at the Boston Consortium for Arab Region Studies and was on the faculty at the American University in Cairo between 2012 and 2019. Larry Pope, former ambassador to Chad and chargé d'affaires in Tripoli, Libya, in the aftermath of the Benghazi attack. He retired from the U.S. Foreign Service after 31 years of service. And U.S. Senator Angus King is here for part of the show. He serves on four oversight committees: Rules, Intelligence, Armed Services, and Energy and Natural Resources. Joining us on the line from Washington, D.C., Aaron David Miller, a Middle East analyst and senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, focusing on U.S. policy. Welcome to all of you, and thank you for being here on Maine Calling on this Friday. And as always, we want to hear from you and the audience. What are your questions as you watch all of this unfold? Are you worried? Are you feeling more comfort now? Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Senator King, I'll start with you. You are privy to more information than the rest of us are at this point. Are you convinced that Iran was planning imminent attacks on the U.S. when the decision was made to kill General Soleimani?
I want to answer that question, but I want to start with something that I think all of us will agree to, and that is Soleimani was a bad guy. He was very dangerous. He was a terrorist. He had been working throughout the Middle East for a number of years. The real question, and it goes to your question, is was this a good strategic move at the time, and was it justified under the circumstances? The answer is I'm still not sure. I had two classified briefings last week, one in the Intelligence Committee. One was an all-senators briefing that's somewhat now famous based upon Mike Lee and others' reactions afterwards. I'm not convinced that there were imminent attacks. And, we get into what is the definition of the word imminent. There have been low-level attacks around the Middle East, of course, for many years. That's Soleimani's stock in trade. The question is, was there evidence at the time? I have not seen intelligence yet that has convinced me of that fact. Now, there may be other reasons. I think a stronger reason was a sort of reset of deterrence with Iran, that they perhaps felt after the events of the last 6 months that they could attack Americans, attack Saudi Arabia, send missiles into areas of the Middle East with impunity. And certainly the death of Soleimani has sort of reset the deterrence with Iran and basically made them understand that they can't act in those ways with impunity. But again, whether it was a good strategic move, because, and we can go into this, I believe there are a lot of negative fallouts from the decision that may end up compromising our interests in the Middle East and, in fact, the prospects for peace in the Middle East.
We're having this conversation at 1:09 on Friday afternoon. Just found out that President Trump has increased the sanctions against Iran, just announced a couple hours ago. What is your reaction to that?
Well, my immediate reaction is we reached a pause period this week where there was the killing of Soleimani, there was a missile strike by the Iranians, and then both sides appeared to say, okay, that's it. And in fact, President Trump specifically talked about wanting peace and how Iran can be a vigorous and prosperous country. And then to impose additional sanctions, it seems to me, is sort of daring Iran to take further action. I believe that if you want peace, then you've got to open some dialogue. The president has sent signals to Iran that we're open to talks without any prior conditions. But imposing additional sanctions, it seems to me, doesn't open the door for those kinds of talks. It sort of forces Iran back into their shell. And one of the greatest strategic fallouts from the killing of Soleimani is the unification of the Iranian people behind the regime. There was a wonderful set of interviews yesterday in the media of individuals in Iran, not political people, software engineers, young people, mostly in their 30s, who basically said, we don't like the regime, but we really don't like what the president did. We're Iranians first. And 2 weeks ago, Iranians were protesting in the streets against the regime. Now they're in the streets protesting against us. And so we've sort of strengthened the position of the regime within Iran, which is not in our interest. And of course, if we end up being expelled from Iraq, which is, I'd say, a 50-50 possibility at this point, ironically, that was one of Soleimani's principal goals.
Aaron, David Miller, I want to bring you into this conversation. You have called the killing of Soleimani a bold and reckless move. Others have said the world is now a safer place. We are a week away from that. Do you still see this as bold and reckless and making the world a less safe place?
Let me just first pick up on a point that Senator King just raised. You know, I had 25 years State Department working for a half a dozen secretaries of state. Both political parties. I've worked for Republicans and Democrats. I've voted for them, too. And one of the things I fundamentally learned is this. When the United States undertakes an act of great consequence, and it involves a deployment of military forces or an action such as this, there are three questions that need to be asked. Not just can we, but should we? And number three, what will it cost? And my entire concern about this is that it reflects a drift in this administration's foreign policy on the subject of Iran. Killing Soleimani, and I won't argue the moral the moral justification here with respect to how much blood he has on his hands, not just in terms of American blood, but the blood of his own citizens, as well as Syrians and Iraqis. But it is this action, as far as I can tell, was completely untethered from any sense of strategy, consequence, or coherent or rational policy. And that isn't just a today issue. That's been apparent since the President of the United States, for reasons that had nothing to do with the national interest, but was driven by his ego, his political interests, and his aversion to anything remotely related to Barack Obama, decided to withdraw the United States from a highly flawed but still very functional arms control agreement with Tehran. And we are living, sadly, tragically, with the consequences of that. So, no, if you ask me, are Americans more secure? Are citizens of the world more secure? Look at the unintended consequence of what happened yesterday in Iran. A gratuitous conflict between the U.S. and Iran, a reckless and incompetent move by Iranian air controllers and radar operators, and an incomprehensible decision to put civilian aircraft in a conflict zone, which is extraordinary to me, resulted in the deaths of 176 people and the destruction of so many lives and so many worlds. Unintended consequence. And sadly, there's more to come.
And Larry, I want to follow up on that. Let's add that Ukrainian jetliner. Our allies are saying that a missile took it down. There seems to be video evidence that this is the case as well. If that is the case, what are the implications?
You know, bad things happen when military forces are in close proximity and in areas like the Persian Gulf. I'm old enough to remember in 1988 when a U.S. naval vessel shot down an Iranian airliner, Iranair 655, killing 290 people, believing that it was under attack. So I think we have, as Aaron suggested, we have to worry about the fact that we have forces in the area in close proximity to Iranian forces, that everybody is operating on a hair trigger, and it's a dangerous situation.
Jennifer, one of the most profound books that's influenced my thinking on issues like this is The Guns of August by Barbara Tuchman, which is a brilliant study of the beginning of World War I, which, by the way, started with the killing of Archduke Ferdinand. The problem is the danger of accidental war.
Yes.
And we saw the what appears to be an accident yesterday that shot down the airliner. What keeps me up at night is a rogue element of a Shia militia in Iraq taking it upon themselves to kill a group of Americans, either under the orders of Iran or against the orders of Iran. But then they've crossed what appears to be a red line for this president, which is the killing of Americans, and we could be in another escalatory ladder, which we barely got off of this week. This would be a very different conversation if those Iranian missiles had killed Americans in Erbil or at Al-Asad Air Base. So the danger of an accidental set of circumstances that triggers a response and escalation is still very much present. And I think that's where I agree with Aaron that the world is not safer now than it was this time last Friday.
And for the record, Larry Pope was nodding the whole time you were talking about the Allison Hodgkins. We haven't even come to you yet. And I want to ask you about the geopolitical consequences of what's going on right now.
Thank you very much. And it's a real privilege to be here today with everyone. I think it's really important to put this crisis in the broader context of developments in the region and in the world. And when I think about the implications of this event on U.S. strategic interests, thinking really broadly, the thing that comes to my mind is, does this help us ensure stability throughout the region? And also, how does this contribute to our efforts to, for example, see a peaceful resolution to the situation in Syria, a peaceful resolution to the situation in Yemen? Does this help us increase our leverage in terms of, you know, salvaging any aspect of the Israeli-Palestinian peace process? And fundamentally, the answer to that question is absolutely not. In fact, it sets us backwards. And more concerning to me, when I think about what this does in terms of the changes that I've seen in the region in the last few years, is it increases the perception among our Arab allies, our Arab Sunni allies, that the United States is unpredictable and unreliable, and encourages them to further their outreach to Russia and China. And those two actors in particular have been very aggressive in terms of expanding their influence. And this really increases, accelerates that trajectory. I know that King Abdullah, His Majesty King Abdullah of Jordan, has apparently made a call to Putin in the last several days. These kinds of things should
be
concerning.
And Russia has generously offered to sell anti-aircraft equipment to Iraq.
Of course.
Just this week.
Right, right. And these are the things that we should really pay attention to. I also think that this move weakens the credibility of the European Union and the EU interlocutors because, you know, their whole thing that they can deliver to Iran is the possibility of sort of, you know, managing the U.S. and managing the Trump administration so that they can hold on to the Iran deal and get some sanctions relief. This has really yanked the rug out, which is going to further push Iran into the embrace of China and Russia. I don't see how that makes it easier or is helpful for us in terms of pursuing our strategic agenda in the region.
Aaron David Miller, Soleimani's goal was to get the U.S. out of Iraq. Has his death accomplished this?
I think given the fact that we've invested 17 years and thousands of Americans have died. Tens of thousands have received wounds from which they will never recover. Scores of thousands of Iraqis have perished. We spent $1 trillion in what remains of our credibility and created a baseline of risk aversion for acting responsibly that will now continue to affect, as it affected Barack Obama, as it affected Donald Trump. It'll continue to affect every American president. And at the moment, our capacity to maintain a tenable, sustainable relationship with the government of Iraq is highly fraught. I think, in large part, the killing of Qasem Soleimani has enabled the Iranians to change the channel. The protest movements directed in large part against an extractive, incompetent Iraqi government, as well as its Iranian supporters in the popular mobilization units or forces, has now been changed. The focus of anger is on us. Our capacity to confront ISIS has been constrained. We now have to worry not just about security of our force deployment and our diplomatic personnel, but a sense of security. We're going to end up investing millions of dollars now in hardening sites, and the anxiety level, which is lethal to cooperation between Iraqi and security forces and American forces, is now fraught. And I worry about green-on-blue violence like we've seen in Afghanistan, where an Afghan trainee turns his automatic weapon against an American trainer. What happens in the event that an Iraqi Shia, angered, not controlled by Iran necessarily, to the senator's point, decides to kill several Americans? What does the administration do then? I really do believe this was ill-advised, ill-conceived, and no one thought through the potential consequences. And I think it creates a set of unintended consequences that will continue to play out in the months.
I'd like to ask a question of these folks here who know more about this, the history in this region than I do. But there were three issues with Iran that Obama confronted and Trump confronted. One is seeking a nuclear weapon. Number two is exporting revolution and their malign influence. And the third is the development of ballistic missiles. Obama made a choice that we can only really deal with the nuclear side, and that was the nature of that agreement. It's been criticized because it wasn't more comprehensive. I think they realized that was the best they could do. The problem I see is that the export of revolution is a core value of the Iranian revolution itself. Revolution is part of the name of the country. And how do we contain that without essentially asking the Iranian regime to change who it is? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Larry?
You know, 40 years ago, Ayatollah Khomeini took over from the Shah, who was our ally, and he brought a remarkable sort of heretical, really, notion of Islamic governance. The idea in the Shia world before that had been that the world was a veil of tears, Shia couldn't aspire to political power. And so he created this notion of Wilayat al-Faqih, the rule in Christian terms, by a pope. It was a remarkable departure, and the conclusion was that in order to sustain the revolution, as the senator was saying, the revolution had to be up on the barricades all the time.
And have to be exported.
And it had to be exported. Well, the Iranians saw themselves as surrounded by Sunni Arabs on the Gulf side, allied with the United States, Israel, and so a little bit like Napoleon after the French Revolution concluded that you had to take the fight outside the country if the revolution was to be protected and sustained. So it's part of the character of the Islamic Republic to sort of be on the barricades, whether it's in Yemen or Iraq now, exploiting the opportunities presented by the United States, or Syria or Lebanon.
Allison.
Yes, sure. Exporting revolution is what they're all about. But again, I want to put it in the regional context. Think about Saudi Arabia. Living in Jordan and places like that, you see Saudi influence, how it spreads through with the Wahhabism, what's preached in the mosque, all of those kinds of things. Think back to the days
of the heart of the Al-Qaeda philosophy
came out
of Saudi Arabia.
Right. Think about the days of Jamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt, and the export of revolution and these ideas are part of the a region that's been in turmoil really since the end of World War I, certainly World War II. And my perspective is we're not going to get them to stop exporting their revolution any more than we're, you know, ideology is something that you just have to kind of work around and look at where can we make pragmatic agreements that maintain stability.
Well, that was the nuclear deal.
Right. And that's one of, you know, that's something that's really important to go through, is that a regime that wants to survive will be pragmatic.
I'd only add that you've got a regime that is driven by a profound sense of insecurity and grandiosity. And that combination in a human being is lethal. And in a nation state, it's even worse. And I would only add to that, you're dealing with an adversary. There are three consequential states in the region today as the Arab world loses so much of its cohesion and its influence. While the Arab world melts down in Libya, in Yemen, in Iraq, in Syria, the three non-Arabs emerge as the core actors in this region. The Israelis, the Turks, and the Iranians, they all have the capacity to project their power abroad. They all have competent intelligence organizations and militaries. And we are now engaged with perhaps the most ruthless of them all. One is a member of NATO. One is America's closest allies, however much divides us. But the Iranians have the advantage of geography, of demography, of history. They can marshal Shia fighters who are prepared to sacrifice themselves for any number of reasons in defense of the Islamic Republic. We don't have those sorts of assets on the ground. It is fantastical to believe that the United States is somehow going to find a way through its own deployments of forces, political or economic influence, to fundamentally expunge Iranian influence from Lebanon, from Yemen, from Iraq, and from Syria. You can do some measure of constraining, but you're left with a basic reality, and that is we are like some modern-day Gulliver wandering around in a part of the world where this president would rather not be, tied up by powers both great and small, and constrained by our own illusions.
And I think it's important to underline that a war with Iran would not be a five-day affair. This is a country of 80 million people, incredibly sophisticated military, missile defense, one of the best in the world. It would be a major confrontation. If you look at the geography, it's mountainous. It'd be very difficult to get there. And I know Jennifer wants to take a break.
Yes. Yes, we're late for a break. I'm talking about Iran with four top minds. We'll have your comments and questions when we get back. This is Maine Calling.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Midcoast Symphony Orchestra's Free Instrument Petting Zoo for kids in Topsom this Sunday afternoon, midcoastsymphony.org. And Dean's Suites, now in two Portland locations, celebrating 15 years of specializing in hand-dipped truffles, caramels, buttercreams, and other seasonal chocolates.
The secret to love? It's in this equation.
W at T plus 1 equals little w plus IHM brackets HT.
That's so romantic.
Oh, yeah. I struggle to find anything you can't get an interesting perspective on by using math.
I'm Guy Raz. How numbers rule the world. Next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
That's coming up tomorrow afternoon at 1 and Wednesday evening at 11 here on Maine Public Radio. Are you looking for something to do? Do you want to let folks know about something your organization is sponsoring? Well, the community calendar is your answer. It's online at mainepublic.org. It's easy to enter information about your event. Just fill in the form. And it's easy to find things. You can search by type of event, date, or location, and there are hundreds of events listed. Maine Public's Community Calendar, bringing the people of Maine together with concerts, exhibits, workshops, lectures, and baked bean suppers, and quite a bit more, all at mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, what's next for the Middle East in response to what's happened in Iran this week? My guests are Senator Angus King, Aaron David Miller, who's a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Allison Hodgkins, non-resident fellow at the Boston Consortium for Arab Region Studies, and Larry Pope, former ambassador to Chad and chargé d'affaires in Libya. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll start with Bob in Cape Elizabeth. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling. Bob, are you there? Please go ahead. Bob? Okay, so we're going to go away from that call, and we're going to go to Billy calling from Augusta. Hi, Billy. Go ahead.
Comment and a question. Based on all the information, it appears that President Trump was advised to eliminate a terrorist leader responsible for the deaths of Americans and worldwide. And based on all the evidence, it appears that Iran is responsible for the deaths of the people in that jet. My question would be, is the death of Soleimani, will it save lives? Will it save American lives, and will it save lives worldwide? I'll take my question off the end. Thank you.
All right, Larry, a lot of people think it will.
Well, Soleimani was an officer, a major general, and heading the Quds Force, which is part of the Iranian armed force structure. He was immediately replaced by another general officer. He wasn't carrying a suicide vest. He himself was not presenting an imminent threat to American institutions. There's no question about the fact that he was a difficult character, a bad guy who had run Iranian affairs in Syria and Lebanon and Iraq and elsewhere for 20 years. But he was the officer of a state, the uniformed officer of a state. We've created an extraordinary precedent here by killing a Soleimani as he was visiting Iraq. It's a precedent that puts a target on the back of every American officer in the Middle East, civil and military, I would say. So, and I don't think it makes us safer. I think it makes us a good deal, puts us at risk a good deal more.
Jennifer, I think Billy asked exactly the right question. And the question is it, you have to balance. Clearly, there are going to be lives saved by the fact that Soleimani is not around because he was brilliant in terms of planning these attacks around the Middle East. He's been doing it for a dozen or more years. The question is, what's the downside? And it looks, at least at this point, and none of us will know for a year or more, or probably 5 years, as to what the ultimate result of this is. But by solidifying the strength of the regime in Iran, by perhaps leading to our expulsion from Iraq, for opening for ISIS, it looks like the downsides outweigh the benefits. It's not a straightforward, was this a yes or no decision? And the question is, could we have achieved the goal of putting the Iranians on alert that we weren't going to tolerate what they were doing without killing the second most important man in the country?
I'd also point out that can anybody identify one example in the modern history of the Republic mm-hmm. where a U.S. president authorized a targeted killing? We won't call it an assassination. It has legal implications. But a targeted killing of a senior government official, Senator is right, arguably the second most powerful and important man in the country, and then claimed responsibility for it. This is not killing Osama bin Laden. This is not killing Abu Bakr Baghdadi. You'd have to go back to World War II when the U.S. Navy intercepted Admiral Yamamoto's plane and killed him in an operation called Operation Vengeance in response to Pearl Harbor. And that was during the time of war. I think this really is untethered, and that's what needs to be explained to the American public and, frankly, the rest of us. Exactly what was the strategic rationale and the strategy of eliminating Soleimani? That is critically important. It's a question to ask, and there's been no satisfactory answer.
Allison.
I think it's really important that we're bringing up this point that Soleimani was not a terrorist in the Osama bin Laden sense. He was the representative of a state. And by carrying out what we're calling euphemistically a targeted killing is seen by leaders in the region, by the people in the region, as an act of war. Whether we see it like that is sort of irrelevant to how it's being perceived. And that ratchets up tensions to a whole new level where people are asking themselves, you know, what is happening to the rule of law? The United States is supposed to be the protector of this international system. And if the president of the United States is ordering the assassination of officials of foreign states, what does that mean for the entire enchilada? And that really should be alarming to whatever your position is on international law or the United Nations. That should give us all pause.
We'll go to Dan calling from Sugarloaf. Hi, Dan. Go ahead.
Yes. When Khomeini did the Islamic Revolution and he took our hostages in the embassy, it changed the whole region. And it spread that Islamic Revolution all the way from there all the way to Gaza. Don't you think that there was some intelligence, the fact that inside of our embassy when they stormed it, Soleimani's name was spray painted in there? And what was Soleimani doing in Baghdad right there? I believe there's intelligence that shows that he was planning to take hostages in our embassy.
Dan, thank you for your call. Senator King, you're on the Senate Intelligence Committee. What do you say to Dan?
I have not seen the intelligence that would verify what Dan just stated. I can't say that it wasn't possible. Soleimani has been planning attacks. Ironically, Soleimani had been holding back the Shia militia in Iraq from attacking Americans because at the time, anyway, they saw some common interest in fighting ISIS because ISIS is antithetical to the Shias in Iran, just as it is antithetical to us. What Soleimani's intentions were in the next weeks or months is a matter of some debate in Washington. What I can tell you is the intelligence I've seen does not verify that. There's pieces missing that I'm looking forward to seeing next week based upon conversations with senior administration officials. So I'm sorry to be a little cryptic, but I can't talk about classified material.
NPR's own Jane Arraf reported the day after the assassination that the Speaker of the Iraqi Parliament said that Soleimani was in Baghdad to receive a letter from Saudi Arabia with a proposal to de-escalate tensions, which in fact would be the opposite of what the caller was suggesting, that he was actually there to sort of open some sort of a regional dialogue.
It is clear that he had an appointment with Mahdi, the head of Iraq, that day.
Dan, thanks for your question. Aaron David Miller, I want to turn to you and ask you, what does all of this mean for Israel?
You know, I think the Israelis who were part of the joint CIA-Mossad operation in 07 when they killed Imad Magnia in Damascus, and apparently Qasem Soleimani was within 50 feet of Magnia, and a decision was made, whether jointly or by the Bush administration, not to eliminate Soleimani because of the consequences. I think the Israelis understand in a way that it's harder for us to appreciate that this is significant and positive. I suspect there's a good deal of elation, but at the same time, they also realize that they're proximate. And if Iranian threats to launch against Dubai and Haifa, even 40 or 50% of that is true in the event we struck Iran proper, then the Israelis are extremely worried and concerned, as they should be and as the Saudis and the Emiratis are as well, that the elimination of Soleimani also produces a situation in which Mr. Khani does not have either the relationship with the supreme leader, the charisma, the effectiveness, or the control to manage, to the senator's point, to manage and to constrain to some degree. And I'm not here to write a brief for Soleimani for sure, let alone for the Islamic Republic. But it could well be that the eliminating Soleimani has also eliminated a fair measure of command and control over a variety of forces that could easily undertake attacks against American civilians or military that could prompt an American retaliation against Iraq. One last point. I think we have to just face the sobering reality that in the Middle East there are no victories. There are no comprehensive solutions. There are no slam dunks from Afghanistan to Iraq. Israel's victory in 1967 has produced consequences that at least half of the Israeli public understand in the possession of both the West Bank and even with Gaza withdrawal that have posed huge demographic and political challenges to the integrity of the state. This is a broken, angry, dysfunctional part of the world in which we're stuck. We need to be smart about it. We need to be disciplined about it. And we have to understand, last point, that the Middle East is littered with the remains of great powers who wrongly believe that they could somehow impose their will on smaller ones. And the history of this region suggests they can't.
Well, the nickname of Afghanistan is the graveyard of empires, going back hundreds of years.
We do have to take another quick break. More conversation about Iran and the Middle East when we get back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Dead River Company, committed to keeping Maine's homes and businesses warm and proud to be part of celebrating Maine's bicentennial, deadriver.com. Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. And the Rehabilitation Center at the Cedars, safely transitioning over 800 seniors home each year. Learn more at thecedarsportland.org.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
On January 10, 1791, Portland Headlight was lit for the first time. Construction began in 1787 at the directive of George Washington and was completed on this day using a fund of $1,500, established by Washington himself. Washington had engaged two Masons from the town of Falmouth, modern-day Portland, and reminded them that the early government was poor and that the materials used to build the lighthouse should be taken from nearby fields and shores.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Roosevelt Campobello International Park. Happy birthday, Maine.
. 2020 is a big year for New England politicians, with two Democratic presidential frontrunners from the region, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren.
We win when we have big enough ideas to meet the big problems in people's lives, and we get out there and fight for them.
This week on Next from the New England News Collaborative, we look at where things stand in the presidential race and impeachment, plus the role of coal in our power grid. Please join us.
That's coming up today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Iran, U.S., and the Middle East. My guest, U.S. Senator Angus King, Larry Pope, former ambassador, and Aaron David Miller with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Also here, Allison Hodgins with the Boston Consortium for Arab Region Studies. We have some big minds in the studio with me today. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. We're going to go to Constantino in Westbrook. So many calls, Constantino. Want to ask you to speak quickly, if you will. Thank you.
Sure. I'll try my best. Thank you. I appreciate your panel's knowledge of the historical, analytical, and geopolitical aspects of the situation, but what my fear is that you have to look at this in the context of Trump. Trump is going to do what he wants to do to bolster his image for re-election and to distract from impeachment. Clinton did it, Nixon did it, and I'd like to, bottom line, he's going to do what's good for him regardless of the situation, and I'd like to hear some commentary on that.
Senator King, I'll turn to you.
It's tempting to speculate about that, but I know that what he did last week in terms of Soleimani was motivated to a large extent by the advice of Mike Pompeo, who has been a hawk on Iran for many years. I think he felt that he had to do something, that he had appeared weak by not responding to the shoot down of the drone, and that Iran was getting the idea it had a free rein. The question is, were there things that he could have done other than the killing of the second most important person in Iran that would have reset that deterrent situation? And also, did they think through fully the consequences? They're engaged in this maximum pressure campaign, which is essentially trying to squeeze the Iranian economy to the point where the Iranians just give up and come crawling to the negotiation table, say, what do you want? I don't think there's a perception that they're dealing with a several thousand-year-old civilization, the Persian civilization, that are not inclined to do that. And so my question is, what's plan B? Are we just going to squeeze and squeeze and squeeze and be surprised when Iran strikes back in some way, shape, or form, and inevitably lead towards some kind of warfare and conflict?
And related to what you just said, Senator King, a tweet from Marfine, there was reporting about how defense officials presented Soleimani as one option among many, yet turnaround without interagency discussion and dissent is unsettling. How were safeguards, checks, bypassed? Will the Senate conduct a review of the process and officials involved?
The Senate should. The question is whether or not the Republican leadership of the committees, the relevant committees that would naturally be interested in looking into this question, whether they're willing to do so. Other than Mike Lee and Rand Paul, the Republican side of the aisle has pretty much lined up in support of the president. And so I think that's an open question. There should be a discussion. Clearly, there should be a discussion of how this decision was made, what the options were, what considerations there were, and whether the decision was made through some kind of thoughtful process that weighed all the risks and the benefits. It does not appear that that was the case.
We have Dan on Facebook saying, what is the long-term objective for having such a large military presence in the Middle East today? Our large footprint only seems to exacerbate tensions in the region and not one of stabilization. Larry, I'm looking at you.
Well, the president, of course, has said that he wants to draw down that footprint and end these 9/11 wars, and we seem to be moving in the wrong direction if that's his objective. Our presence can have a stabilizing effect. When I was the political advisor down at the U.S. Central Command, we kept the peace for 3 years with a brigade on the ground in Kuwait and a naval force in the Persian Gulf, and that was a pretty good, I think, force posture for us. The Iraq invasion and the consequences of that have been horrific, of course, and it would be, and we've since used our presence in Iraq, reinforced our presence in Iraq in an effort to sort of deal with ISIS. That effort has been compromised badly by the Soleimani killing. Because it's leading to increased pressure on us to withdraw our forces.
There are at least two topics we really haven't touched on very much, and in these few last minutes, I want to at least touch on them. Allison, I'm going to start with you. We're talking, of course, about potential for war with Iran, but there's all sorts of potential for proxy wars, aren't there? And what are you concerned about in specific?
Well, when I think about what's going to happen next, we look at what Iran did immediately after with this targeted strike that was sort of a de-escalation through escalation. It was a very, you know, calculated response. That's not going to be the end of it. But Iran cannot withstand any kind of a direct confrontation with the United States. They know that. And so they're going to work through these proxy militias that they have all over the region. And this is where our regional partnerships, our regional entanglements really make us vulnerable, much in a way that we think about the scenario in World War I, where if you have a situation where, for example, Hezbollah attacks Israel, or just yesterday, Israel attacked, I think, a target inside Syria, and 8 Iranians were killed. If you have a situation where one of these proxies attacks either Saudi Arabia or Israel, things could very quickly escalate out of control because the Iranians will say, well, that's not us. The Iranian ambassador just said yesterday, we can't be responsible for the acts of these other proxies. And so you're going to have this tit-for-tat cycle. We have other actors in the region that are willing to take action as well. And so we could be in a situation where things could spin out of control, even if there is no direct confrontation between the United States and Iran.
Aaron David Miller.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. Heretofore, we were operating in what you could legitimately call a war of the shadows. I'm stunned, frankly, that the Syrian battlefield over the last 7 or 8 years did not produce any kinetic conflict of sustained or serious nature between any of the parties, and that battle space was so crowded. With this Soleimani killing and Iran's own claiming of responsibility for launching against bases in Iraq, we are now out of the shadow wars. And I don't think there is any more plausible deniability. I think it's quite likely that there will continue to be proxy attacks. The only question is, as far as I'm concerned, which way does the Supreme Leader and Donald Trump want to go? I mean, they do share one common objective, regime maintenance for sure, with respect to the Supreme Leader. He cannot afford a massive sustained 4 or 5 week air, missile, and cyber campaign against Iran without thinking seriously about its impact on internal stability and regime control. Donald Trump has one strategic imperative between now and November: acquittal, vindication, an impeachment trial, and reelection. The last thing he needs, frankly, is a major confrontation, which shows a spike in oil prices, a meltdown in financial markets, economic catastrophe, and a lot of dead Americans. That's the only constraint, the political one, I see that could possibly preempt the grimmer scenario.
Jennifer, one of the realities that I think it's hard for us as Americans to understand is this idea of these militias. Think of the main Democratic Party having its own army, armed. I mean, that's what's going on. I was in Baghdad and Erbil. In fact, I landed at that airstrip in Erbil that was struck the other night, and in the Kurdish area of Iraq, they have two different Kurdish parties, each of which has its own militia and is armed. And within Iraq, there are these, they call them, they're called Shia militia. Some of them are pro-Iraq, some of them are pro-Iran. And that's where I think one of the greatest dangers right now is. The other thing that we haven't mentioned is cyber. Iran has significant cyber capabilities. And cyber is harder to attribute, it's harder to track, it's cheap, and they've already been poking around in our critical infrastructure. And I think that's an area where we're vulnerable. The scary part the other day was Zarif, the foreign minister, said, after the airstrike on those bases in Iraq, we're concluded with our retaliation. The Supreme Leader did not say that. He said, this is a slap in the face of the Americans, but this is not over. I worry about a cyber attack here in America that might not be catastrophic, but would be damaging and something that then the question is, how do we respond to that?
We just have about a minute and a half left, and I need to address a whole lot of our listeners here are making a similar point on phone and on email, and I'm going to read Jean's. These discussions usually start with 52 American hostages in Tehran. We really started it in 1953 when the CIA instigated a coup, setting up a Shah, a murderous, corrupt dictator. Iranians know this. You're nodding, Allison. You agree with the callers
Iranians
and emailers.
Iranians know this. Arabs know this. Everyone in the region puts what's happening now in that context. And Americans are not aware of this longer history of U.S. involvement and how U.S. involvement matches up with the machinations of our regional allies.
She's absolutely right. We think Iranian history started in 1979. For them, it started in 1953, and they have very bitter memories of our installation. And we overthrew their government, installed the Shah, and the Shah turned out to be a pretty rough guy.
All right. Let's see if we can get to one more very quick question. Well, what I want to talk about, and I won't go to calls for this, is what happens now, Larry Pope, with the nuclear program? Do you expect Iran to develop a nuclear bomb?
Well, Iran is still in the nuclear deal, at least on paper. And our allies, of course, and members of the Security Council are anxious to maintain what can be maintained of it. But the Soleimani killing has added to pressure, I think, on the Iranians to jettison the lost bits of that with the with the inspectors who've been at the Iranian facilities. If they do so, and if they move to enrich uranium to the point where it becomes weapons grade, they will be very close to the capability of developing a nuclear weapon, and they are developing the missile capability to deliver such a weapon. That's not a possibility that any American president, I think, could view, could allow to happen. So there is the risk, the near-term risk of an unintended clash in the Middle East as a result of the presence of these forces, the militias, the conflict in the Persian Gulf. But there's the longer-term sort of Damocles that's hanging over our head, which is the Iranian nuclear program.
It's very important to know that they were in compliance with the nuclear agreement when the president abrogated it.
All right. I've got to go. That's U.S. Senator Angus King you just heard there. We're also here with Larry Pope, former ambassador to Chad, and Allison Hodgkins with the Boston Consortium for Arab Studies. And Aaron David Miller has joined us from a studio. This is Maine Calling. Have a good weekend.